We have had the incredible privilege, because God saw fit to bring about this wonder of his revelation through the Word of God, to follow Jesus through his life journey over the last few years as we have traveled with him, not only from his birth and bumping into him at age 12, but also primarily from the time that he was baptized into ministry and then went through temptation and into Nazareth and then into Capernaum, and then just followed him through the miraculous and extraordinary run that we've had with him as we have sat under his teachings and listened into what he has shown us and started discovering through the miracles and the power and the wonder of Jesus that it is very likely, very possible that this man Jesus is in fact not an ordinary man at all, that he is the promised Messiah, the one that was going to come and rescue, at least in this context that we've seen him, at the very least rescue Israel, his people, and bring them back into a place where they exist under the protection and wonder of God. Because as we know, during the time of Jesus, Israel has now been not only under the occupation of Rome for a very long time, but they have really spent hundreds and hundreds of years just in some form of slavery or another under the occupation of some huge group or another. If it's not Babylon, it's Persia. If it's not Persia, it's Rome, Greece, whatever. I mean, it's just, Israel has not been what it was meant to be. So as we have followed Jesus, looking at it through the eyes of the people there, the Jewish people, this is an exciting time, because it seems to be that the Messiah is coming into Jerusalem now to rise up and to overthrow Rome and once and for all to establish Israel. And so you can imagine, as we enter into Jerusalem, we followed him from Jericho up that road into Jerusalem. We're here now, and we are entering into the Passover, which seems to be at least a good time to really bring everything together. And we are now sitting in that Last Supper we know as the Last Supper. They didn't know as the Last Supper, because it wasn't their Last Supper yet, right? He hadn't died yet, and they didn't know all this. So even when we say the words Last Supper, it takes it out of context, because for them it was just another Passover. Passover meal. And in fact, perhaps not just another Passover meal, the Passover meal that would possibly sort of bring into being the beginning of the wonder of Jesus bringing about redemption for Israel. They had no idea that Jesus' redemptive work was not only going to expand beyond Israel and graft in and incorporate all of the Gentile world as well, giving us a means by which we could be made right with God, but also that the means by which this particular redemptive work had to take place was opposite of anything we could imagine on this planet. It required death and failure and what seemed to be a brokenness. And we had no idea, they had no idea, that in all of that horror, Jesus was going to effect something so extraordinary that to this day we still feel the deep ripples throughout human history, both past and future and present. And we are sitting in that meal. I mean, how cool is that, that Jesus gave that to us by revealing to us the things he said? So today, as we sit and we listen in to the meal and we listen into the things Jesus teaches, let us absorb those things as though we recognize that this is the last moments of Jesus preparing his disciples for what they are about to experience. And what exactly is that? Since we know and they don't, let me just give you a glimpse into it. We're going to be traveling through it in the months to come, but here it is. They are about to watch their leader die on a cross. They are about to feel the deep wonder and horror of losing everything that they thought was going to happen. Then they are going to walk into a couple of days of mourning, only to find him come back from the dead. Then there's going to be a very exciting 40 days or so where Jesus hangs out with them and does some cool stuff. And then they're going to watch him leave the planet. Not a good feeling. And then they're going to experience this moment in what we know as Pentecost, and we're going to see an extraordinary revival take place, and then the greatest persecution in human history in terms of the Christian world, and perhaps arguably in terms of any person that has faced persecution, will happen for the next 70 years. And the disciples, all of them that are sitting at this Last Supper, all of them but John, will die horrible deaths, giving their lives up for the sake of Christ. They will be beaten, they will be imprisoned, they will be persecuted, they will face some of the greatest and most difficult, decisive decisions they need to make about the church, and that's all coming down the pike for them. Can you imagine that this meal might be incredibly important? Can you imagine, since Jesus knows all this is coming, that the words he says here might be incredibly important? Because remember, the life these guys are called into is the same life you and I are called into. Because we call ourselves what? Disciples of Jesus, Christ followers. So we should listen in and recognize that we are called into the life that is going to be an extraordinary life, but a difficult life in many ways. What did Jesus just do at the Last Supper? He just sat down and he just washed the disciples' feet. If you were here last weekend, you heard that story. And he said to the disciples in that moment, from here on out, everything I've taught you, everything I've shown you, it is going to ultimately birth a new life in you. And this new life looks simple. A new command I give to you. Love each other as I have loved you. And how did Jesus love us? How are we going to discover that Jesus loves us? By giving all of himself for us. And so think about the implications of a life where you and I are called into giving all of ourselves for the sake of each other, for the sake of others, for the sake of serving this world on behalf of Christ to make redemption known to him. By definition, the implications of that are uncomfortable and difficult and full of struggle. So it is no wonder that Jesus does what he's about to do in the story we're going to enter into. Peter has just said to Jesus, wherever you go, I'm going. So I know you just said you can't go where I'm going, but I disagree with that, and I'm going to come with you. And Jesus, and Peter actually says it to Jesus in this way. He says, look, I am already willing to give my life for you. So even if you are going to walk into death, I'll walk into death with you. What Peter does not understand, what we could not understand until it was revealed to us after all of this, was that Jesus was not simply walking into death for us. Many a human being have martyred themselves for our sake. In fact, we here know that many of our armed forces, they die to keep us safe, right? So humans have been giving their lives for one another for as long as human history has existed. Jesus is not saying to us, it is death I have to enter into and you can't come with me there. What he is going to do so far exceeds death that we will not, cannot possibly understand the depths to which God went for our salvation. What it meant that God himself, as the triune God, broke himself in two for us, we cannot and will not ever be able to fully perceive. But Jesus says, what I'm about to do, no one can do except me. No one can save except me. No one can redeem except me, because I am the only one that has the capacity to do it. So Peter, you can't be part of this story. In John chapter 14, we step in. You can grab Bibles. They're under the seats. If you don't have one of your own, page 771. 771 of our Bibles, John chapter 14, is where we're jumping in. And of course, right before this, Simon said, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered, where I'm going, you cannot follow me, but you will follow. Afterwards, Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you? I will lay down my life for you. Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will crow till you have denied me three times. And of course, we know Peter is about to violate his inner core by denying the very God he just said, I will die for. And then these words are the next words that bounce off the page or come from the table as we listen in to Jesus sharing with his disciples. Let not your hearts be troubled. Let's just stop there. Let not your hearts be troubled. What an extraordinary thing to say, considering what he's just taught us, isn't it? What has he just taught us? There is a new life I'm calling you into. It is a life of sacrifice, a life where you will give yourself for the sake of others, where you will spend everything you have for the sake of redemption and for the sake of making the gospel known, where you will face uncomfortability and difficulty and struggle because you follow me. This is why Jesus said things like, you take up your cross when you follow me. This is not language that bodes well with the Western cultural experience of our one and prosperity. It is a message that says, everything I give you is for the sake of making redemption known to others through your actions and your words. It's going to cost you a lot, perhaps everything. This is the new life we're called into. No wonder Jesus says, do not let your hearts be troubled, because we're bound to be troubled a lot. Do you understand? We are going to feel trouble. And Jesus begins by saying, I'm about to tell you something that is going to allow you to hold onto something that is going to transcend the very reality that you may find yourself living in if you follow me for real. Do not be troubled. He says, believe in God, believe also in me. An extraordinary statement. I mean, we should be sitting on the wall here listening into this going, you're kidding me. He just said that? He just said, believe in God, also believe in me. What did he just say? I and God are the same thing. If you believe in him, believe in me, believe in me, believe in him, it's the same deal. It is blasphemous in every way, unless, of course, he is God. In which case, it is not only not blasphemous, it is something that should stir in us the greatest sense of wonder and awe that we can begin to imagine. And then he says this, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. And you know the way to where I am going. That is just the oddest thing. See, we take passages like this and we make them normal by reading them at funerals all the time, right? And so we're like, oh, I know this one. This is the big house one, the mansion one with the rooms. I've heard this before. And this is like in the sky, there's a big house. And you know what it ends up doing when we don't understand what Jesus is doing? It ends up making our Christianity look like a joke. It does. It looks like we're like the tooth fairy people and we've painted a big house in the sky with many rooms and your room is like light blue because that's your favorite color. And I mean, I've heard this kind of stuff, right? And so we read this and it's like we see Jesus going, don't worry, don't let your hearts be troubled. There's a big house in the sky and it has rooms and you're cool. And doesn't it sound Father Christmassy, Santa Clausy? Unless, of course, you understand what Jesus is doing here. What Jesus is doing is what is very typical of any good teacher, any good rabbi of his time, and frankly, any good teacher of our time. It is taking what is common to the culture, things that make sense to you and me, things we experience every day, and bringing them into a reality that we can't comprehend, into a mystery we can't understand, and by bringing that picture in, the mystery is revealed for what it actually is, and we go, wow, no kidding. So Jesus here is speaking of the greatest mystery that any of us will face in our lifetime. It is the mystery of death. We are going to die. You and me, we are going to die. It is inevitable. You are not going to live forever. And at some point, you will watch somebody die you love, and at some point, somebody will watch you die. That is how it plays. And Jesus is about to die, and it is going to feel to the disciples like all is lost. Why? Because death is an end. And at the point of death, everything we experience on this planet is lost to that end. And now Jesus is about to turn that idea on its nose. He's going to go, watch this. I'm going to spin it. And when you understand what is actually going on, you are going to go, really? Well, then what am I concerned about? So Jesus said, here's what's about to happen, boys. As you watch me go into this next experience that you cannot follow me, think of it this way. It's like a wedding. It's just like a wedding. And I am the groom, and I'm going to go and do what grooms do before the marriage. And then when I'm done doing what grooms do, I'm going to come back and get you, and I'm going to take you to myself, and you're going to experience the joy of new life. That sounds pretty standard, right? Especially if you understand Jewish weddings. Because here's how the weddings played out. Weddings are a pretty cool deal. How many guys like going to weddings? Oh, we all love weddings, right? I mean, there's always a party, there's always good food, and there's always a beautiful dress, and there's just happy people. So who doesn't want to go to a wedding, okay? So here's the deal. You go to a wedding, and here's how it plays out. In the Jewish culture, parents would get together with parents in a tight community because everything revolved around the synagogue in that tight community. And so the people all knew each other really well and you knew each other's kids. And parents would kind of do what parents do in our culture. They just do it in a more secretive manner than they did it in that culture. They talk to each other. Don't you think your son and my daughter, I mean,
They're so cute together. We should talk.
And so they would talk. And then at a certain point, those two would be betrothed to one another. They would come together and they would recognize through a multiple different options and means that they were going to be married. And at that point, there would be great anticipation for the coming wedding. It is like our engagement period. It was different in that culture because it had some other things that went with it. Some responsibilities we have long since forgotten. And so what would happen is the groom would say to the family of the bride, I must go and prepare a place for my bride because I can't exactly bring her into my father's house and have her sleep in my father's bed. That would be odd for the four of us to be together there. So I need to make a plan with this, right? So here's what would happen. This is exactly how it played out. He would go back to his father's house and he would build onto the house a room. He would build a new room, but he had to build it by himself with his friends if he wanted, but he had to build it. He had to be the one that prepared it. And when the room was finished, that was the sign that he could come and take his bride home. And she would be somewhere else, and she would not come by the house to visit. That was inappropriate. She would, generally speaking, oftentimes not necessarily even know where he's preparing the room. It's like he's doing a room somewhere in town. It's really cool by dad's house. He's building it on. And when he's finished, he'll come and get you. And so the bride would wait at home, like all brides do in the process of marriage, nervously scared out of her mind and excitedly waiting for it to happen because she's in love and it's beautiful and he's a groom. And of course, in this culture, in the Jewish culture, unlike our culture, we recognize that if somebody did not get married, it was an incredibly difficult thing. See, our culture has created a world where if you're not married and you're a woman, this culture is, I mean, it's all yours. I mean, there's careers and there's stuff and you can provide. And I don't know whether it's ideal or not ideal, but that is what it is, right? In this culture, that's not how it played. Marriage for a woman in this culture was really, in many ways, I say it this way, her salvation culturally, okay? She wouldn't be looked down upon, she wouldn't be looked weird at, and she'd have provision. If she wasn't married, she was with mom and dad, and that was odd. So for a bride, this marriage thing was a big deal. And the groom would prepare a room, and when the room was prepared, he would come to the house. And you'd see him coming, and you'd wonder, I wonder if the room's ready, or if he's just kind of going to buy some more wood. And then he'd come by the house, and he'd knock on the door, and he'd say, the room is ready. And everybody would call their friends and people would come and the wedding feast would begin and it would go for 2-3 days of partying and stuff. And then there would come that moment where the groom and the bride would go to the father's house, enter into their new room, consummate the marriage and live together there, beginning a new life. That was a wedding. And listen to what Jesus is saying. Guys, when you think about what's going to happen next, when it looks bleak and dark, when it seems everything is lost, when I am dying on a cross when I should be overthrowing a government, when I am buried and you wonder how you got caught up in this mess, when it seems like life has left the building, do not let your hearts be troubled, because I have only left for a time to go and prepare a room for you. I am like a groom, and you should wait for me as a bride waits for her groom, anxiously and nervously, wondering what is death going to be like? I mean, what's it going to be like to go live in a new life and in a new place with God? And I don't know. There should be a little trepidation in us about that journey, but it should not be filled with mystery and fear. It should be filled with wonder and awe. So that when things get tough, when things get hard, when it seems like the darkness is winning and the light is leaving, your hearts will not be troubled because you know the story. You know the story already. And then Jesus says these words, you already know the way. You already know the way. Isn't that an odd thing to say? It'd be like me saying this to you. We're going to go over to Bob's house for a party. I'd love for you to come. You know the way. And you go, who's Bob? Where's the house? And I don't know the way. And I go, no, no, no. You already know the way. You already know how to get there. No, excuse me. I don't know how to get there. It would be an odd conversation, wouldn't it? And that's exactly what Jesus says. He says, you already know the way. Now, in the context of this story, if the disciples were listening properly, when Jesus made that statement, the light would turn on in their head and they would go, oh, I know what he's saying, because he's just given us the clue, right? This is like a wedding. I'm the groom. I go, I come, I get you, I take you home. So in that context, you're already feeling it, aren't you? You already know the way could mean something other than we're used to. Not like you know where the house is or you have a map, but you do know the way. So if I were here and I said to you, I'm going over to Bob's house and we're going to have a party, and you say, I don't know where Bob's house is, and I say, you don't worry, you already know the way. I'm about to explain to you what I mean. This is what happens. Look, here actually, a good question is asked. He says this. Jesus said, I'm sorry, right before that, verse 5. Right after he said, and where I'm going, and you know the way to where I'm going, verse 4. And then Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Do you see? We don't even know where you're going, let alone knowing the way to where you're going. I don't know Bob, and I don't know where his house is, okay? And then Jesus speaks words we have often used as a single verse outside of this context, unfortunately, and we've kind of thrown them around like they're just words. Jesus says one of the most famous and most quoted parts of the book of John. Jesus said to him, I am the way. I am the way. There it is. Can we just stop there for a second? I am the way. It would be like me saying to you, don't worry, you know how to get to Bob's house. I am your map. Follow the big black van outside in the parking lot. You could see it from a mile away. And I promise you, I will not lose you. I will not lose you. You follow me, and when we're finished, we will be at Bob's house. And that's what Jesus says here. Friends, he says at the table, you already know how to get where I'm going, because I'm going to come and get you, and I will take you home. You don't have to worry about how you're going to get yourself there. I've got that covered. It is, in many ways, the most extraordinary and the most wondrous thing we could possibly hear. Take all your concerns, all your ideas, all your concepts of how you will get yourself to heaven, to home, to be forever with God. Take all of that and set it aside off the table, because I am your way. All you have to do, all you have to do is follow me. That's it. Do you see how it all starts coming together? Do you see how all these ideas and things we throw around in the Christian church, follow Jesus and believe in Jesus and have faith in Jesus, and when he starts telling a story like this, it all begins to make sense. He's the groom, he goes, he prepares, he comes back, he gets you, he takes you. So what's your part in the story? Wait for him, grab his hand when he comes, and follow him. That's it. It's your part in the story. Because you don't know where you're going. You've never been there and you didn't come from there. So that's a problem. And the truth is, when we understand the rest of Scripture, the problem runs far deeper, because even if we knew the way, we could not go, because the chasm between us and there is so deep and so dark and so wide that it holds only one thing in it, and that is death. And any launch we make from here to God lands us in death. So the only way to be able to experience life in death is to know the way, the groom, and that is Jesus. As though to expand on this idea so that we're not left simply with a, I am the way, believe me, he now does something unbelievable. He expands that word and he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So he says, I am the way, I hold the truth, I define it, I am it. You know that by now because you followed me long enough to hear my teaching, and you've said many times, He teaches with authority like nobody else. It's like he knows truth. It's like he is truth. And then he lands this last little piece, and I am the life. And here Jesus lays it out for us. It's almost as though he, in one single sentence, says, I am your way into truth, and I'm the only one that brings life to the human soul. There is no other life to be found. I am life. So he's covered the gamut, right? There's nowhere else to go. He's the way, he's the truth, and he's the life. I think this is a stupid question. I'm not so sure, because I couldn't figure out, even in this context, why Philip would ask this question, except for the fact that Philip was not listening properly. But Philip, if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Why would Philip ask this question? Because Jesus just said this. Jesus just said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. So here Jesus is making the greatest of all statements in John chapter 14. I think it's even greater than the way, the truth, and the life, because this ties back to something that happened in numerous occasions in the Old Testament, but in specific occasion, the one we're most familiar with was with a man named Moses. Jesus is actually saying to the disciples, listen to this as you're watching this table, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. I am the full revelation of the Father. I am him to you. Do you understand? If you've ever desired to see God, just look at me. I am the Father. In the Old Testament, Moses at a certain point was walking along and this bush was on fire. And it was kind of odd because it started talking to him. And then we call it the burning bush experience. And Moses speaks to the bush, and it turns out the bush was God. And so Moses experiences this very tangible display of God. And it was this teeny tiny piece of the revelation of God, right? Then Moses, after that, experiences the God doing extraordinary things, setting his people free from the whole experience in Egypt, right? And in that experience, we see the power of God. And then after that, God leads them by day and by night through a pillar of fire and a huge cloud with fire in it. It is extraordinary, right? Then he parts the seas and they go through him. And if you've ever wanted to be part of a time in history where the full revelation of God was taking place on this planet, I think that would count as one of them, wouldn't it? I mean, every time you turn to the left or the right, there was a new revelation of God, a full, beautiful, extraordinary demonstration of who God was. And then on top of all of that happening, Moses still goes up to the mountain and he meets with God on the mountain and he comes down with the law, right? And then after that, what does he do? God, I don't feel like I've seen enough of you. Can I see you? Can you like show yourself to me? I mean, I think at that point, when you've seen all that, that would not be necessarily the most appropriate thing to ask for. I feel like God would say, you've already seen me. But God doesn't say that to Moses. He says, okay, I'm happy to show myself to you. Here's the only small problem in that. If I show myself to you, you die. Because no human being could survive experiencing the full revelation of who I am. No one could survive that. So here's what I'll do. I'll hide you in the rock. I'll place you inside of this place and you can kind of peek out like this. And then the Hebrew actually literally means, and I'll pass my hindquarters past you. That's kind of what he says. It's like, I'll just swing on by really fast while you're hidden in a rock, and then you'll catch a glimpse of me. And that's exactly what happens to Moses. And in that glimpse of God, it so deeply impacts him that literally he just shines the glory of God again, right? And then it says a step further, Moses would sit in a tent and he would meet with God as a friend meets with a friend. Like something happened in that tent. It was cool. It was awesome. So you would think if anyone has had a full revelation of God, Moses falls into that category. Do you know what Jesus is saying here? Are you ready for this? Jesus is saying to the disciples, if you think Moses saw God, you couldn't be more wrong. He caught glimpses of God. Do you want to know who saw God? Who sees God? You, because I'm here. This is how God is displaying his full glory and revelation to us, through Jesus. Guys, you'll probably be thinking about this all week, and then at a certain point it'll hit you, and you'll just faint. That's what I'm hoping. Because I recognize that we don't understand what I just said fully because we're not fainting. This is the full revelation of God standing before us. We should be sitting at this table with our mouths dropping open and just going, "You mean if I see you, I see the Father?" Yes. There is nothing you need to know that goes beyond me. If you know me, you know God. Wow. That's why it's so odd that Philip says, "Okay, that sounds really awesome. If we could just see the Father, that'd be really cool. That'd be enough." Do you see how silly that question is now? Are you saying we could catch a glimpse of the Father? No, Philip, I am not saying you can catch a glimpse of the Father. I'm saying you're seeing him. Jesus says it. Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you so long and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his work. Believe me that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me, or else believe on the account of the works themselves." He's saying, if you can't see it straight up, think about what you've experienced in the last 3 years, Philip. What have I done? Okay, there was the calming of the storm. That was kind of cool. The walking on the water, the bringing back the dead. There were all the miracles. There was that whole thing of control over the entire demonic world. I mean, there are some things you should play back into and go, that does seem kind of odd. I am God. So when I say the words, "Do not let your hearts be troubled, for I am going to prepare for you a place as a groom does, and I will return," you ought to go, "Wow, thanks. I can't wait for you to come for me. And in the meantime, whatever life you call me into, as hard as it may be, as dark as it may feel, as burdensome as it may become on this planet, I see now. This planet's story is not the one where I'm supposed to be seeking out all the wonder and comfort for myself, because what I'm waiting for is real life when you come and get me. So for now, what do I do?" And Jesus was very clear. "I just told you, I washed your feet. So do what I asked you. Live the new life. Love one another as I have loved you. Spend yourself for others." Why? Because others must know what redemption does to the human heart. When a human being comes in contact with the way, Jesus, and they are redeemed, and their hope is now set for eternity because he is preparing a place for them just as a groom does, and their anxious wonderings are for another world, then this world becomes nothing but an extraordinary opportunity for mission and to live out the reality of redemption, and every burden becomes our honor and our opportunity. It stares prosperity theology in the face and shows it to be deeply flawed. It says, no, the new way is not seeking your new prosperity from God. It is finding your life in him so that this life becomes his for him to do with whatever he pleases. When Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," in our global context, it sounds very exclusive. It sounds very arrogant, doesn't it? I mean, think of all the different paths to heaven that exist out there. And Jesus has the audacity to say, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody gets to the Father except through me." Seems incredibly narrow-minded, but it's not at all. You must listen to what Jesus is saying here. If he is an absolute lunatic, if he is the greatest liar the world has ever known, then we should stop following him. But if indeed he is Lord of the universe, then these words become a whisper to our soul that run deeper than anything we can imagine, because here's what Jesus is saying. Are you ready? No one else is coming for you. No one else is coming for you. No other gods, no other God loves you. No other God passionately pursues you. No other God longs to forgive you. No other God waits to heal you. No one else is coming for you. So you can spend the rest of your life running, chasing philosophies, ideologies, concepts, problem solving, working diligently to make yourself a better man, a better woman. You can go into any self-help. You can follow any religious experience. Go for it. But none of them are coming for you. None of them are here to rescue you. They are means by which you spin your wheels to feel as though you're making progress when all that's happening is that you're walking one step closer to the greatest mystery of all, death, only to find it to be exactly what it is, death. Unless you recognize that I have come for you, that I do love you, that I do passionately pursue you, that I long to forgive you, and I long to heal you, and I have the power to do it, because I am life. This moment, sitting in this dinner, listening to this conversation, should reshape our souls, whether we know Jesus or whether we don't. If we don't know Jesus, it should be a simple concept to think about. The invitation is simple. Choose life. No one else is coming for you. He is the way, the only way. It is inclusive, not exclusive. It is for everybody. And he's inviting you into the story. I am the way. If you know Jesus, this should stir in us deep things. Are you burdened right now? Are you living in some form of difficulty? Are you breathing heavily? Are you anxious? Do you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders? Have you stepped into some insanity that is bigger than you thought it was, and it's trying to squash you and kill you, and it's trying to show you that you're nothing but a bug and it's big? Are you in a place where you look around and you go, maybe it's finally too much? I am, just so you know. The darkness rises. I'm busy writing some little blog things, and the title for my blog on the airplane back from Chicago this week, as I went to visit with the Molines as their mom passes into this extraordinary life we've just talked about. I'm flying back, and I've just talked to Brooke in the mess that is our current home and the wonder of all of it and the transitions we're going through, and my blog title was "The Darkness Rises." The darkness rises. It's coming for us. And then as I wrote the title of that, and I started writing about what it feels like when darkness comes for you. And I was preparing for this message today and thinking about the words that Jesus said, "I am life." I remembered the words that we spent 3 weeks, 2 weeks ago, and these words came to me. Psalm 149, verse 11 and 12. Ready? If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me is night, even the darkness is not dark to you. And the night is bright as day, for darkness is as light with you. It's not that you overcome darkness. Darkness is as light to you. You and I are called into a life that will cost us a great deal if we follow Jesus. Whatever the Christian world in the Western culture has told you otherwise, don't believe it. Following Jesus is not easy, and it will call you into a life full of missional living with extraordinary price to pay. But do not let your hearts be troubled, because when the darkness comes for you and you feel like it's too much, you already know the way, and he is already coming for you. He is already redeeming it, and he already has. If you don't know Jesus today, choose life. No one else is coming. Please choose Jesus. Find somebody and say, what does it mean to believe Jesus is who he said he was? What does it mean to take his hand and say, I'm following him? If you know Jesus, leave here deeply encouraged from this little story that you know the way, and whatever else comes between now and then, is just an opportunity and honor to make redemption real. Circumstances are so irrelevant. No wonder Paul said, I have learned the secret of being content. I know Jesus. Let's pray. God, I pray, Spirit of God, that you would speak deeply to our hearts, because I cannot in words capture the magnitude of what you've just said at this table. I cannot possibly express to these people here how deep this reality runs. I cannot possibly, with all of my words and all of my animations, bring to life in the way it ought to be brought to life what we have just heard. So I beg of you, Spirit of God, show us deeply the depths of what we've just seen. To those here, God, that do not yet know you as Savior, whisper now. Tell them no one else is coming for them, but that you've already come, and that you love them, and that you invite them into life. Show them that following you is life. And for those of us that know you, Jesus, stir up in us again the beauty of what it means that we already know the way, and encourage us in our troubles, in our darkness, that our hearts need not be troubled, because you are enough and our destiny is already set.